Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 62 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I spoke with Dr. Catherine Kearns, a professor of classics at the University of Chicago. Her interests include classical archaeology, Bronze, Iron Age, social, cultural, and political history, landscape and environments, and archaeological method in theory. Her research examines the intersections between social and environmental change in Mediterranean landscapes during the Iron Age period. In this episode, we chatted about why she chose to specialize in the Iron Age, how looking at ancient environmental changes can help us better understand history, and why humans are so curious about environmental apocalypse collapse narratives in the media. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy.
Thanks so much for joining me this evening, or for you this afternoon. I just wanted to start us off, get the ball rolling, and ask what I hope will be a pretty fun and simple question, which is, how did you get into classics? Like, where did this love of the ancient world come from?
Thanks. Yeah, that goes all the way back to high school for me. I grew up outside of Philly. I went to a public high school, and I had this Latin teacher who started interspersing maps of ancient Rome and sort of descriptions of buildings, and it started to become much more, I don't know, rich to me. We weren't just reading text, we were actually thinking about the places that some of these people would have been walking around. And I liked history a lot, and so it started to get me interested, you know, can I study history through things like places, materials? Because I liked the Latin, but I kind of wanted a little more. I wanted some, you know, something more to sink my teeth into.
Nice. And I mean, that's awesome that it started in high school. I know not everyone is
lucky.
Yeah, not everyone's lucky enough to have that. So, you know, was it the material alone, or did you have like teachers or someone that was also able to deliver the information that got you super excited?
You know, it's funny. I was joking about this with someone else in the way that pedagogy of languages has changed. And I'm old enough that, you know, this was a Latin teacher who otherwise just drilled the language into us, drill sheets, rote memorization. And I was really excited when she would pause and bring in these other elements. So we would look at, you know, maps, and we would pause to think about, you know, a building in the Roman Forum. And she would get us really into like, well, this was the Temple of the Vestal Virgins, and thinking about, you know, gender. And it got her interest piqued in a way that, you know, sitting there and doing drill sheets wasn't really getting it. So she was great. I mean, I obviously loved my teacher and I had a lot of fun, but it was very much a language class. And then I also was lucky to have European history classes that were also incorporating more than just the sort of great books. So things like monuments, architecture, maps, geography. And it just, yeah, it just opened a way for me to think about doing this that wasn't through this kind of memorization, but that maybe I could travel to some of these places. Maybe I could actually join a dig. And it was the first kind of exposure that the study of the ancient world could be much more multifaceted.
That's awesome. And like, by the time you're ready to go to college and everything, did you have a pretty good idea that like, this is something you could pursue at the collegiate level?
Yeah, I think if I go all the way back to that period, I definitely was interested in it as a major, archaeology. So this is when I started to think like, cool, archaeology in that abstract way that a 17-year-old thinks about careers, right? Cool, like this could let me travel and get my hands dirty and do history and maybe do languages. And it seemed really idealistic. But at that point, I'm sure I hadn't thought like I'm going to be an archaeologist. It was more like I ended up going to George Washington, which had a major in archaeology, and it was very interdisciplinary. You took anthro, you took classics. Suddenly you become more aware of what the actual profession looks like at these various registers. Yeah.
Nice. And so once you like chose all this, and then when you made the decision to go to grad school, how did you go about figuring out what you wanted to specialize in?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I had been really interested in architecture and in places. I tend to be really interested in maps and in like kind of spatial distribution of things. And so I thought when I was going to grad school that I was maybe going to do like Roman architecture. And I was really interested in, from the moment that we excavate a building to how we reconstruct it, to how we think about it as a lived place, you know, how do the spaces around it inform that? And so I went to Cornell particularly because it was really strong in things like landscape archaeology and in architecture. And I think that interest in placemaking has kind of stuck with me. I've switched directions. So I will say to any grad student that you might come into grad school thinking you want to study something and it will totally do a 180 potentially based on opportunities or interest or classes you take. But there are certain things that I think I've continuously kind of come back to. And a big one is like, how do we as humans relate to space? How do we make meaningful places?
Oh, that's so cool. And I think I read somewhere that you kind of specialize in the Iron Age period. Is that right?
Yeah. I guess you could broadly say in the Mediterranean, and my work in the last decade or so has been on the island of Cyprus. So that is one of these shifts. I, you know, went with an advisor to Cyprus to join a dig, and I found a really rich sort of space to write a dissertation in. But I hadn't gone to grad school thinking that that's what I was going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's fascinating. Like, it's not a period that I think I personally know a lot of people who went into. I know most of my friends, maybe not strangely, but they all went into like classical or Ptolemaic, you know, periods, Hellenistic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what is it that's awesome about the Iron Age? And for all the listeners who don't get to hear about Iron Age, you know, like, yeah, what is there to study?
Yeah, that's interesting because I think it depends on where you're working and the discipline you're working in. So there are some sites, for example, Athens, where you might immediately think of classical Athens, but the study of its formation is actually a really big topic and subfield. I just got an email about a symposium that's all going to be about the geometric and archaic periods of Athens. So those 8th, 7th, 6th centuries where the polis is kind of forming and the city-state is emerging. And I think for people who maybe aren't as familiar with the period, that is one of the really interesting aspects of it. Across the Mediterranean, that early first millennium horizon is one in which we're seeing these new kinds of political and social formation emerge, not everywhere all at the same time and all looking the same way. So that's why I said, like, if you study, you know, the Levant, what is now Syria, Lebanon, Israel, there's a very different history happening there as opposed to like the Eastern Mediterranean or the Central Mediterranean or further west. But for me, the Iron Age was really interesting partly because of these kind of historical questions, the rise of the city state, economic growth. We have a lot of evidence of population growth. So what's happening in terms of various transformations in economy or society that are leading to some of these developments. But also because, as you mentioned, a lot of interest tends to skew to either end. A lot of people study the earlier Bronze Age that precedes it or study the classical period that follows it. And so it's this kind of really compelling transitional period that is often constrained by the sort of disciplinary research questions from either end. So a lot of people, for example, who study the Bronze Age consider it a sort of period of decline and coming out of that. Or people who study the classical period see the Iron Age, again, as a sort of like primitive, archaic period out of which comes the grandeur of the classical period. And so I wanted to just think about it on its own terms, you know, try to blend some of those more macro historical questions.
That's really cool. I mean, you know, I don't know people who really take the time to study that period. I mean, I know one person who is kind of into like archaic period, but they're like, yeah, you know. So I'm like, oh, okay. Well, this is, I mean, there's probably a lot there, but I just don't get to hear of it.
Well, so the other way to ask that question is, why don't more people study it? And then you get into,
yeah, you know what? I want to know.
There are fewer texts. That's a big one. The textual evidence is much more fragmentary. And so many of the kinds of research questions that you can ask for, let's say, the 5th or 4th centuries are much harder to ask of the 9th, 8th, 7th centuries. Also, the ways that archaeology has sort of constructed that period tends to focus on things like tombs, or evidence that we do have for elite residences. On Cyprus, for example, we have a lot of interest in the palace. And that means that we don't have as much evidence for things like residential occupations or land use or economy. So the Iron Age is also constrained by some of these limiting factors that make it sometimes frustrating to sort of ask the same kinds of research questions. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, it's fascinating. I guess it also falls within, because I know it's popular to basically just sort of sit down and choose, okay, I'm going to be a philologist and I'm just going to hopefully study a lot of texts. And then the other split is, okay, well, I'm going to go into archaeology and I'm hopefully going to look at majority material culture. So, but I feel like it's interesting because even though archaeologists tend to say, okay, well, I want to go look at materials, but a lot of materials like have text on them, right? So isn't it kind of like, yeah, okay, it's like both? Because I mean, you could, the majority you're studying the artifacts, but I'm like, yeah, but a lot of it is so like wrapped in, like you can't be an archaeologist and not have studied like some of the languages and stuff, because it's like they will inevitably come up in the work. So
yeah, this gets at some of the histories of different kinds of archaeology. So classical archaeology and its traditions and its development, particularly in the 19th century as the academy is forming, as opposed to what you might call anthropological archaeology or certain forms in the continent or in North America of prehistoric archaeology. And many of these have different trajectories and different disciplinary objectives, different goals. And certainly classical archaeology, as it developed, was intimately tied to the study of languages through epigraphy or through, you know, using material culture to support or flesh out the text or vice versa. So we could think of some of the earliest classical archaeologists using the text to locate and find sites, or that conditions the way that they interpreted what they were finding. But there are other ways of doing archaeology, and I think the field is in an interesting moment where you're seeing certain graduate programs not de-emphasize language learning, but not make it as central to something like classical archaeology if your research questions are not necessarily dependent on intensive language instruction. So there, I think classical archaeology is really cool because it is capacious. And you can have people who study objects that have writing on them or that are embedded in these really rich textual archives or sources. And then you have others like me who work on Iron Age Cyprus, where we still haven't deciphered one of the languages that was concurrent at the time that Greek was being spoken. And so language and texts aren't necessarily informing the research questions that we're asking. So I think the field is moving in a way that we're allowing for that more capacious training. But certainly you do have some kinds of classical archaeology which are very much dependent on language training.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, I do want to talk about Cyprus because it's, I don't know a lot of people who study Cyprus, and I've always found Cyprus very fascinating. But I mean, and this is showing obviously my unfamiliarity with it because there was no classes when I was a student that taught me about Cyprus at all. I mean, people just glossed over it. So as from someone who doesn't actually know anything about ancient Cyprus, what does the early civilization look like on Cyprus? Because I think it, in my mind, I'm kind of like, oh, is it sort of like the Minoan stuff? Or is it like the like mainland Greek stuff? Like, I have no idea what it is. So I'm really excited to hear what's there.
Yeah, and that's a similar disciplinary question, right? Because Cyprus is sort of elliptical to classics and to Near Eastern studies. And that's partly because of its position in the Eastern Mediterranean. It was a site of a lot of encounters, cultural encounters, but it also tends to be sort of marginal to the study of the Aegean or marginal to the study of the Near East. And so in many cases, it's not taught in a lot of curriculums. And it's led to a really interesting field of archaeology on the island, where you're getting a lot of influence from Cypriots, as well as from different kinds of disciplinary background, prehistory, classics, Near Eastern studies. But to get to like what did civilization look like, I guess it depends on what time period you're interested in. Some of what makes Cypriot culture really interesting and complex is that it does show influence from different areas at very early horizons. There are, for example, a really burgeoning field of research questions on the earliest inhabitants of the island, so seasonal foraging, Neolithic communities. By the time of the Bronze Age, where we have, especially the Late Bronze Age, where we have urbanism, the urbanism is really exciting and looks in some ways planned. You have orthogonal grids and then in others more dispersed. So it's showing certain cultural traits from the Near East, as well as writing systems that are engaged with things from the Aegean. So there's a lot of mixture. There's a lot of evidence of cultural encounters and the sort of entangled cultures that come out of that. And the first inscription that we have that shows a Greek speaking person is 11th century, so pretty early. And Cyprus is also really interesting because that evidence of inscriptions and engravings and the written word continues into the Iron Age. So we have a really interesting writing culture happening on the island. By the time of the Iron Age, so like 9th, 8th, 7th centuries, we have accounts that refer to kingdoms. So this is one of the differences that scholars bring up, as opposed to like the Greek world, where you have the polis formation, and some of these are kings, some of these are oligarchies, and eventually of the development of things like democracy. On Cyprus, the textual evidence that we have suggests that these are hereditary kingships that last for quite a long time. That doesn't mean that there isn't some kind of mechanism of civic, you know, collective authority, something like the citizens and the king, but it doesn't, at least the Greeks seem to have positioned the Cypriot kingdoms as slightly different.
Interesting. Well, because you mentioned, obviously, its unique position being so far toward the Middle East, but also not being Middle Eastern and having different influences hit it. I was going to say, do we see, is there more evidence that points to it, you know, being Hellenized, Greekified versus like getting ideas from nearby Egypt and other things? Because I know Egypt also had those monarchies.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge area of research, really exciting research. Some of it coming from the limited textual sources we have, others from archaeology. But yeah, people really trying to think about these cultural encounters with the Phoenicians. So we have early evidence of the Phoenicians establishing settlements on the island, trading off of the island, Greek-speaking people, Anatolian, you know, like Luwian or other kinds of Anatolian language, Egyptian. And so because it's an island, that raises a lot of interesting questions about how it's facilitating that exchange and contact. So especially the development of certain maritime trade networks using the island for staging stopping points or for harbors or for exchange. The political economy of the Cypriot city kingdoms or the states, largely driven through these exchange mechanisms. So things like exporting copper or foodstuffs, agricultural produce in exchange for other kinds of goods. And we see a lot of this exchange very early on in the material record. So these questions of identity, community, social boundaries, these are really interesting for the Iron Age horizon.
That's so cool. And I think I, again, read somewhere that you also have an interest in kind of like climate change stuff.
Yeah, so I was becoming interested in the Iron Age period, so this period of transformation. We start to see a kind of solidification of inequality, you could say. So aristocratic classes, kingship. And I was really interested in approaching that from a kind of like landscape, land use set of questions. So what is the rural economy like? Can we tell from the growth of other kinds of settlement patterns how something like the agricultural economy is part of those transformations that leading to something like the city-state with these hereditary kingships? And when you start thinking about landscape, these questions of environmental change start to come up. And archaeology has done a really great job over the last few decades in thinking about the dynamics of human-environment relationships. So we're starting to get very good at reconstructing ancient environments, or at least using the available evidence that we have. Paleoclimatic analyses are becoming more frequent, the data are becoming more highly resolved, and so we're starting to tell new stories of environmental change. And so I was really interested in grouping that kind of evidence together with the archaeological material. So can we better understand, for example, how some of these settlement changes in where people are living, in potentially the kinds of agricultural economies that they're engaged in, how they are shifting alongside environmental changes? Because we know that the past was not static in terms of environmental change. We're getting better at recognizing these shifts. But I'm also concerned that we don't write a history that just says, you know, things got dry and cities collapsed, and then things got wetter and economies got better. So I was really cautious of that, because we're starting to also see people who are interested in writing environmental histories that do really use these refrains of rise and fall or collapse, much of this being driven by our own anxieties, right, about climate change, about environmental change. So I wanted to just, you know, what is the evidence that we have? Can we start to think about how people were engaging or not with these environmental changes? Was it shaping something like where people were living or the kinds of economic choices they were making? And how does that help us better write something like the history of the Iron Age?
That's so cool. And I love what you said about, you know, we're getting better at recreating ancient environments and this, that, and the other thing to sort of study, you know, what happened in the ancient world. But it's funny because it also triggered like this memory of what I always say, which is the past informs the present. But in this case, almost, I'm wondering, you know, how much does the present in terms of modern technology for recreating these environments and stuff, how much can that affect how we study the past? Because I'm always looking for the sort of interdisciplinary ancient to modern connections there. I know when people talk about, you know, oh, we gotta study climate change now, we gotta figure out solutions now, and then a popular suggestion has been, let's look to the ancient world, and a lot of people kind of poo-poo that, and they're like, yeah, but that's the ancient world. But I'm like, yeah, but if we're using similar technologies, isn't there like a lot of crossover? Can't they really help each other?
Yeah, so there are a lot of questions in there, some of which are about how the kinds of techniques that we have for, let's say, reconstructing the climate 3,000 years ago, And you're right that there are certain limits to those that really condition the sort of the questions that we can ask. So I mentioned that we're getting better, more and more resolution for some of these archives. So we're able to really try to map out, let's say chronologically, the regional climate of something like Southern Turkey. But we're not there yet in connecting that record to what humans are doing on the ground. And there's a lot of slippage in our ability to identify particular environmental or ecological or climate changes and then actually connect that to human practices. The biggest one being time and time scale. It is really hard to get, for example, to something like a human's experience with weather through some of these techniques. And so what we end up doing are painting these broader pictures of, well, this period appears to have more water availability. It's wetter. That would have had these attendant effects on something like a semi-arid landscape of Cyprus. But that doesn't necessarily answer the question, like, what are farmers doing in response to that? And so this is where we really have to be interdisciplinary, and we have to use the archaeological evidence, any textual evidence that we have, to make that a more complex picture. So that's one set of limitations, is, you know, how do you actually connect regional climatic changes to something like what people are actually experiencing and the decisions that they're making? And that can be really difficult with the resolution that we have. The other set of questions or, you know, limitations that you brought up is the sort of filters that we have in the present and what we're concerned about, which tends to be something like resource depletion, environmental degradation, societal collapse because of, you know, supply chain ruptures connecting agricultural foodstuffs to urban markets. Like, these are the things that are really pressing now when we're thinking about global warming or climate change or the Anthropocene. And many people look to the past to find examples of that. And I, in my work and in my book project, I try to caution that the past, you know, shouldn't just be a series of examples to either make us feel better or, you know, help us respond in a certain way to something. They're more really useful and worth exploring because they show us the complexity of human experiences and the ways that society and politics and economic choices shape how we relate to the world around us. And in some of these cases, it's not always collapse. And in other cases, it's not always resilience, right? So it's in trying to better understand how complex humanity is, and also to show how certain human environment relationships can reproduce inequalities or politics or social boundaries and how we understand that today. Yeah, so there are ways that archaeology is incredibly helpful for conversations on modern climate change, but I think we need to be cautious that we're not superimposing, you know, neoliberal capitalist ideas onto the past or vice versa, or saying that somehow the past can be a model for the present, because I think that also gets into some of these issues with either romanticizing the past or a kind of nostalgia for other environments, a doomism in the way we think about climate today, where everything is being funneled towards like destruction. So these are some of the things that I try to argue we should keep in mind when we're studying human environment relationships across, you know, many millennia or centuries.
I mean, I think it's a good reminder. And also I find myself sometimes commenting or reminding people when they talk about the past that obviously there's always you can't account for like natural disaster and you never know when they're going to happen. So obviously we know the ancient world has had many different sorts of disasters, whether it was the volcano in Thera or Pompeii or something. But obviously that goes into kind of the environment we study after it happened and kind of we see the evidence for what it did to the world. But, you know, we have a lot of like dormant volcanoes now that we don't really know if they'd go off or not. Or
yeah, and you know, there's been a lot of really cool work on disasters and catastrophes. So for example, trying to think critically about how the ancient Greeks or Romans perceived some of these disasters. And again, the idea is like, we don't just map our own anxieties onto the past, but we try to think about how they approached environmental, you know, resource depletion or massive landscape changes or extinction, right? And trying to think alongside them and the materials that have been left behind to ask these more fuller research questions.
And this got me curious because now we're talking about a lot of these catastrophes and ancient like things that have affected our landscape and our world. We have a lot of interest in recreating films in the ancient world that have some sort of horrible disaster, don't we? Like, there's just, I feel like we have so many pieces of modern media that are like, okay, and now the volcano goes off, and now we have the giant tsunami or something like that. So, you know, what do you think it is, it like about this fascination we have for this weird branch of entertainment? Is it just because we like disaster and you need some drama? Or because I'm like, what is it about the genre of like ancient world and then oops, we're outrunning the disaster?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think that, you know, there are probably answers in media studies, but I do think that it's catastrophism is compelling to us. It's in some ways it gets at this anxiety between human, you know, humanity and nature. Throughout history, we have, as humans, come up with different reasons for natural disasters. Is it like a divine sort of smiting? Is it in response to something? Can it be rationalized, right? So like with the progress in things like scientific knowledge and the Enlightenment, where, you know, there are so many interesting questions on the constructs of catastrophes and disasters. But on the popular level, right, they are stories, they are narratives. Many of them follow a kind of rise and fall, which we as humans really glom onto, I think. And this is something that we as scholars also latch onto, because it tends to fall into, you know, like these categories with more evidence, right? We have sites like Pompeii and Herculaneum, which were destroyed by volcanoes. And you see this a lot with studies of ancient climate, where the bad stuff, the disasters, the earthquakes, the droughts, the famines, those tend to produce more evidence because people talked about them, right? It's not really a truism, but it is harder, let's say, in the textual evidence, for example, to find these descriptions of stable climate or stable conditions, right? Disasters warrant a lot of attention and scrutiny, and that's partly, you know, societal responses to how do we fix it? How do we get beyond it? How do we explain it? And so those tend to be the ones that scholarship is oriented towards, volcanoes leading to something like rebellion because they caused famine and the state overreacted and blah, blah, blah. You know, so those chains of events. And it's harder to think about the periods in between. And that's also partly what my book is interested in, because this period of the 9th, 8th centuries, particularly on a place like Cyprus, does seem to be a shift to, quote, wetter conditions. So what did that mean? What did that look like for agricultural economies? What did that mean in terms of who was able to accumulate wealth and who wasn't? How did that potentially generate these new sort of forms of status distinction or stratification? And I think this extends beyond classics. Catastrophism is sexy in many different ways and registers, and it tends to warrant more of our attention.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of modern things, like I think there was that like Geostorm movie, and of course there's the Day After Tomorrow in 2012, but these are very modern ideas where I think we're, not only are we taken by the idea of catastrophe, but we're like, okay, well, what would it do if we destroyed a big metropolitan city like New York or something? But I like to spend my time thinking, okay, but where is the fascination and the joy of seeing an ancient, like a catastrophe, but hitting the ancient world? Is it because we're in love with the idea of seeing, okay, well, what would a disaster do to these monuments? Like, what would happen if we saw the pyramids like hit by whatever? You know, is there something different about the ancient world when we make so many different things about destroying that? Or is it just because, you know, I have no idea.
Yeah, I think that's another big question that could go in a bunch of directions. I think some of the stories interest us because we know what happens after. So it, you know, we can kind of question the resilience of certain communities, how they adapted, how they got over said obstacle. I think in others, you know, you think about lost civilizations, which succumbed to some kind of destruction or devastation. That can be an arena for, you know, fantasies of what life could be like. And those can be attractive for, yeah, speculating on civilizations that did things that we didn't do or paths that weren't taken. But I think it would have to depend on maybe the case in what is particularly compelling about it. But I mean, so much work, right, on dystopian, the attraction of dystopian stories. And there's a, you know, there's now climate fiction or sci-fi that is very heavily engaged with these questions of environmental degradation, terraforming, like what happens if we destroy the globe? What happens to humanity? So there is, you know, we always come back to our interests feeding our own anxieties or our own sort of preoccupations. And I know that in many collapse narratives from the past are brought up today to kind of say like, hey, shouldn't we be thinking about this right now? Or what lessons can we learn from this? And I, again, I try to caution against that simply because we're not talking about the same modes of living. And it's the way we utilize the past to sort of flesh out some of these questions and think about human-environment relationships more critically.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because as you were speaking, it got me thinking of a billion different modern media things that have taken on ancient, like climate disaster specifically. And I was like, oh, well, actually, isn't that, I feel like that's the plot to like the Maze Runner series specifically and the Divergent series, because I think those were like based on weather events, not strictly war. I don't remember. There's a lot of them.
I'm afraid I don't know those as well. I think I was too old to have read or engaged with those.
Yeah, to full disclosure, I have not read any of those books. I've only seen the movies, and that's why I'm like hesitating. And so anyone who's probably read them is like, oh, what an idiot, she doesn't know. So it's okay. I don't know, but I believe it was on the premise of specific climate disasters. But I mean, as someone who does kind of study climate, environment, landscape, all that, just out of curiosity, like, do you enjoy these, like, you know, dramatizations of disasters? Or since you study it professionally, are you like, nah, I'm just gonna stand far away with like a 10-foot pole?
I love a good action movie. So there is a, you know, with a lot of these movies, there is a sense of escapism. But I am certainly interested in media representations of this, in speculative fiction and the way that rethinks historically and into the future some of these questions of, you know, resource extraction, energy use, depletion, extinction. I mean, these are really vital questions that I think we can contribute to as archaeologists. But I am also, you know, I'm wary of, some people have called this, you know, a return of determinism, where we project back into the past these filters that start to see things constrained by climate or conditioned by climate. You know, the fall of the Roman Empire induced by climate change. And so I have to say that having done a lot of this work and being really interested in these subjects, I do now sort of pause when I see some of these more popular arguments made, particularly about collapse. And the ways that climate is being represented or reified in many of these works, which I think takes away from the complexity of that, you know, human environment entanglement.
Yeah. Hey, that's fair. I mean, there's so much in there. So, but also, I mean, media representation aside, I mean, are you familiar with the amazing recreations of the ancient world that have been in the popular video game series Assassin's Creed?
I don't play the game, but yes, I've looked a little bit at it. Yeah.
So, you know, obviously not everyone has to play a video game. I don't think it's necessary. I mean, there's plenty of scholars that do, but the technology that's being used in this like hyper realistic representation that they're going for, you know, is this a key thing that could be used to like help make even more advancements? Like, is it something that we should like pay more attention to, or is that like, it's great, it's awesome, but at the same time, because it's also in the realm of purely like entertainment stuff, we can just leave that to the side and say, that's nice. That's very nice.
No, I think pedagogically those can be really great. So much of what we do is visualization, right? It's trying to represent our findings in these comprehensible ways. And I think reconstructions have a lot of value for breaking apart our assumptions about what the ancient world looked like, making them more, I mean, I don't want to use the term accurate, because a lot of this is, of course, part of what we do with visualization. We're making a lot of choices that we don't necessarily have the evidence to back it up with. But no, I think there's a lot of utility in a diverse set of representations that can be used to engage various publics in what we're doing. Absolutely. And I mean, a great part of human environment studies of the ancient world is in reconstructing, almost at like a nuts and bolts level. We can't really ask some of these research questions about, you know, the give and take of agricultural economies with climate if we don't know much about what the climate was like. And so I think it's combining that sort of really important work that's happening with more paleoclimatic analyses, more archaeologists working with geophysicists and scientists and atmospheric chemists to build better models. And there have certainly been arguments that the more interdisciplinary work that happens, the better the models are, not just for reconstructing the past, but also for projecting into the future. Because the more we understand how human land use and how human landscape practices engage with environmental change, the better those predictive models are going to be for the future. So it kind of goes both ways. And there's a lot of value in getting more data, more environmental data, more archives, dating them with higher granularity or more resolution so that we can actually start to pick apart historical processes, or at least match them up or try to think about them with the archaeological evidence. So yeah, I mean, reconstructions and models are really going to be critical to engaging more people with this subfield.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's awesome. And that's, well, as a gamer myself, I will say I love to hear that, because I hope we see more, you know, usage of these recreations of the ancient world. But it also brings up something that I noticed when I was playing the last time, which is, take a game like the ancient Egypt game that Assassin's Creed did. They set it in Ptolemaic Egypt. And so I was a bit disappointed, because I wanted to see, you know, sort of, you know, Egypt at its height. And so a lot of that, they kind of did speculative work of, okay, let's age this. Let's make it look like, you know, a geological event has affected this. And so now what does this old tomb look like? What does the pyramid look like when it's completely covered up? And I think it goes toward a concern with video games in general, but it's like, the sense of exploring a long lost, destroyed, geologically altered space, and kind of like, it's like the idea that you're going into something that's like old and destroyed, and you're finding like treasures in it, and oh, this has been destroyed, let me just dig around, and oh, I can loot some treasure for my game character. And so I kind of don't like, and can see problems with, if we're portraying like geologically worn places in games, you know, I feel like it can sometimes send a bad message. But I don't really, I mean, do you have any idea like how we can combat that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact case you're bringing up, but that I sympathize with that sort of caution, and that we as moderns tend to kind of create a break with the past, right? And the past is in the past, and it's sort of this thing that can be discovered. And that can have deleterious effects on the people who are still living in that place. We can either like sort of siphon them off. And this is where you get into a lot of these sort of colonial assumptions of backwards peoples who are sort of trapped in the past and in these old ways of doing things. And I think a real engagement with environmental history is one way that we can start to see the continuities and the cycles and the ways that seasonality or these other kind of temporal scales break apart that rupture that we have sort of artificially constructed between the present and the past. And we also do this as scholars, right? We always create arbitrary periods. And some of these can become very solidified and, you know, have their own research paradigms or questions. So I'd have to look at the example, but there are, you know, I definitely sympathize with the concern that we sort of hermetically seal off certain pasts, which have then political implications for how we study them, how we think about the heritage of those places, how we populate them with certain kinds of people, and how we connect them to the present. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I suppose I wasn't thinking of one specific example, just because in thinking about the ancient Egyptian game for Assassin's Creed Origins, I know there are certain ancient sites from, you know, like the New Kingdom, and especially the Old Kingdom, that they had, and I just felt like a lot of the time just kind of even exploring in the game, not doing a quest or anything like super specific, I just felt like I walked into a lot of pyramids and structures that were completely buried in sand. Like, oh, you had to go under a sand dune, and then, ooh, it's this mysterious, you know, ancient temple that, you know, look, it's sunk beneath the sand. So the, you know, so it's hidden under a climate, whatever. So.
No, but those, I mean, that sounds like a pretty run-of-the-mill colonialist romanticization of an ancient past that is, and this is a great colonial move, right? You distance the past from the present, which allows you to exploit it or extract it for your own gain, right? Because it has no connections to the present, or you can really close it off as this thing. And so much of what archaeology is grappling with now are the dangers of that kind of thinking, and how we approach heritage as a living thing that has accumulated over time.
Yeah. No, just really interesting stuff that, you know, caught my attention. So figured I'd ask. Mm-hmm. So basically I have like three questions that I usually ask that kind of end the interview portion of the podcast. So the first one is, when you were a student, or you can say for undergrad or grad school, did you attend office hours?
I did.
Nice.
More as a grad student, I would say. But yeah.
Nice. And from your time attending office hours, do you have a particular conversation or memory or something that really stands out to you?
I mean, so I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is that often office hours in archaeology can happen in the field. And I have a lot of memories of very productive, very generous conversations with my advisor, like in a pickup truck, going back and forth to the site where, you know, advice on things like job market or dissertation. So taking advantage of some of those conversations, even if it's not within the sort of like office hour of a class, but really taking advantage of those conversations for asking questions about, yeah, work, career, anxieties about the field, etc. Yeah,
and I guess I should clarify, yeah, I don't see office hours as just being within the bounds of the office time where you have to go. Yeah, it's just, you know, these informal conversations you can have anywhere, but, you know, if it's with a mentor, an advisor, I think it's so nice and it's so cool to be able to just talk to someone about whatever you want. And then the last sort of question I have is, now in your capacity as an educator yourself, if you had to give like an elevator pitch for why office hours or something like an official office hours block is really a great thing for students, what would you tell them?
It's a great way to get to know your professors. So I try to encourage students to come at the beginning of the term just for 5-10 minutes, just to say hi, tell me a little bit more about their interests, what brought them to the class. You can also learn a little more about your professor, why they're teaching the class in the way that they are, how they're structuring particular things in the way that they are. So it doesn't have to be task oriented. It doesn't have to be like, oh, I need help on a paper. It could be about, you know, what's drawing you to a particular topic or reading. Some of the most memorable, you know, conversations I've had with students now as a professor are, you know, about the design of courses, the sort of why did you assign that reading and as opposed to something else? And that's been productive for me as well. Yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah, I totally agree with that as someone who admittedly definitely took advantage of my professor's office hours. So at the end of each podcast, I ask every guest if they would please read Shelley's beautiful Ozymandias poem. And so after you've read it, if you could just, you know, give us your thoughts on, you know, why do you think we people generally seem to like this poem? I mean, it to me, at least, it's a pretty great poem. It's actually my favorite poem of all time. But there seems to always just be some sort of like, I don't know, like it's, there's something punchy about it in a way that a lot of poems don't tend to hit me. So I thought this would be a really nice thing to share with people. And I'd love to hear what you think about the poem.
Okay, let me start.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal, these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, The lone and level sands stretch far away. So my thoughts on this, immediately, I'm drawn to some of these temporal dimensions and references and the constructs of emptiness and yet things that remain. The sort of juxtaposition of words on an object, that's a big thing in archaeology. We're always drawn to the relationship between word and image or word and object. So I think it packs a lot into these 14 lines that you could think about: time, materiality, agency, power. So the juxtaposition of something like the King of Kings and decay. So I think there's a lot that's packed in here.
From almost an archaeologist's point of view that I hadn't thought about, every time I hear it read to me, I swear, I pick up something new. Because I know in archaeology, a big thing is provenience. And one of my professors, I don't remember who it was. Well, I'm sure it's told in a lot of institutions, but basically, I remember a professor of mine saying a lot through the year that absence of evidence does not equal evidence of absence. And, it got me thinking about this poem, like, what desert is this? They said lone level sands, things are buried in the sand. Was this where the statue was originally? Do we know, this could have been moved. It could have, anything could have happened to it. So it's interesting when you sort of read some of the lines, it gets you thinking but are we sure this was meant to be here? Are we talking about the same place, the same person?
Yeah, there's a thing there with monumentality, right? So many of the artifacts when Shelley is writing are portable, right? They're appearing in European markets and museums. But the monuments tended to invoke this idea of durability, of longevity, of fixity. So you're getting some of the allusions here of something that was once in a place and all the other traces of it have gone, and it is the thing that kind of stands still. Definitely interest in the placemaking of particular kinds of materials. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other dimension to this poem that I always take out of it is that I find it a very, very big political statement by Shelley. It's kind of a memento mori, if you will. Yeah, it speaks of kind of like the ephemeral nature of power. When kind of thinking about the poem in that frame of mind, a really fun question I love to ask guests at the end of the podcast is, if we consider our contemporary society, our modern world right now, do we have like a modern equivalent of an Ozymandias? Do we have something right now that we think is like amazing and that it'll last forever? And then like realistically in like 100 years, I used to say 1,000 years, but then I was like, LOL, climate change is probably going to kill us all before then. So that's being like super generous. So I was like, okay, let's try like 200 years or something a little less ambitious, but will humanity look back and be like, yeah, that was great and super lasting and amazing? Or like, will we look back and be like, we're such idiots, what were we thinking?
I don't know. My mind went to many different places as you were talking. Part of the problem, right, is that our sense of time is completely warped in the 21st century, where everything feels more fleeting because of social media and the internet and our abilities to communicate and represent things. Trends rise and fall within hours now. And so I think that has done a lot to our sense of longevity and durability. Like, I bet a decade ago you would have said American democracy would last 100 years, but will it? So there are testaments to power that I think we're starting to see rest on very shaky grounds. There are other things though that seem much more durable in our culture. So for example, I'm thinking of like sports. This is a classic sort of sardonic way that archaeologists think about our work. And in 100 years when we, or 1,000 years when we excavate American cities, is sports mascot, something like that. So there are more durable icons of certain cultures that have very material basis, road infrastructure, for example. I don't see that going anywhere in 100 years, no matter how many people call for, the end of fossil fuels or decarbonization. Like, we will still be driving. Car culture is a really big deal here. So yeah, I would have to think about, you know, the kind of personification of some of those durable things. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, the thing I love about this question is it has to be open-ended, or well, it doesn't have to, but it can be very open-ended, and there is no right or wrong answer. It's just, you know, there's a lot to take in about our modern culture, isn't there? I'm always like, oh man, that's so hard, because there's so many things about modernity that we're like, what? How did, okay. I mean, just, you know, last year I was just like, I still don't understand this whole TikTok thing. I'm like the only young millennial who's probably like, I refuse to download it on my phone, because I'm like, no, I can't. I have, but yeah. So I love the answer, and I hope that other people do as well. So the last question actually that I ask is, where can people find you or your work if they want to follow your scholarly work? Or if they want to, you know, email you and say, hey, oh my God, I love what you study. How do I be your student?
Yeah, sure. So I, you know, have a faculty page at University of Chicago where you can find my email, cmkearns@uchicago.edu. I'm also on Twitter at cmkearnsy, where I share, you know, things like upcoming books, or I like to boost the signal of other interesting, you know, archaeological or environmental historical work. So that's another place to catch me.
Nice. Well, we will make sure to link both of those links in our show notes so people can send you an email, look at your faculty page, see the cool things that you've published if they want to go read that. And then I know Twitter might collapse at any second, but Classics Twitter is awesome and it's still here. So until the whole thing burns down, it's there. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and you know, I hope we can have you back in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. This was fun.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.